Aloha and welcome to Town Square. Usually we're live and invite your calls. To bring you today's guests, we're recorded. It's probably a good bet that you don't think about the technology that lets you pop in an address and get directions or just see where you are. But as GPS continues to change how we go about our daily business, Greg Milner believes it's worth understanding how that technology came into your hands and how it might be changing how you think. Greg Milner is a senior contributing writer and columnist for Spin Magazine. His work has also appeared in Slate, Salon, The Village Voice, Wired, and other publications. He's the author of Perfecting Sound Forever, and his latest book, Pinpoint, deals with how we all understand GPS. We sat down during his recent visit to Honolulu, and we first talked about the genesis of GPS.
The global positioning system really began in the late 60s and got going in the early 70s, but it was basically spearheaded by the military as a way to drop bombs more efficiently. A lot of people in the military didn't actually see the point of that, but it was a pretty small group of people in the Air Force that really spearheaded the idea of inventing this system that could make, you know, the way they saw it, that could make warfare more humane. A lot of them were Vietnam vets, Vietnam Air Force vets, who had been really disillusioned by the bombing campaigns during the war and how indiscriminate they were, and thought that this idea of having a precision weapon system would be a fantastic thing, you know, for warfare. Brad Parkinson, the Air Force colonel, really took the lead in inventing it. He used to say that his goal was to drop five bombs in one hole. That was sort of their mantra, five bombs in one hole.
You interviewed him for the book.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really fascinating talking to him because, yeah, he came out of he had this technical background, but he had been sent to Vietnam to observe some of the precision weapon systems there that were being deployed. And so he came back with a lot of ideas, and he thought that this would be – and there had been some similar research going on by the Naval Research Laboratory. I mean, the roots kind of stretch back to Sputnik, but it was really Parkinson that kind of really got the ball rolling kind of at the expense of his career, he's the first to say. I mean, because he was kind of a rising star, really, you know, kind of wunderkind, and so many people thought what he was doing was just a waste. He tells a story of a general in the Pentagon accosting him and, like, really just poking him in the face and saying, like, you're wasting your career. Why are you wasting a promising career doing this? This is ridiculous.
I bet he's not laughing now.
Yeah, probably not. But that was, you know, it was just a fairly common thing among the Air Force. I mean, part of it is, I think, the institutional culture, that there's the operational people, the people who fly airplanes and maintain airplanes, and that's the bulk of the Air Force. And then there are these space people who are kind of almost seen as ivory towerish by, I think, a lot of people on the operational side. And Parkinson was, you know, he used to call him and his team space weenies. Like, he, you know, he kind of embraced that. Yeah, he had a vision, and a few people around him had a vision. And I imagine the people, the naysayers, if they're still around, aren't laughing anymore.
So how did we go from Brad Parkinson's era to what we all carry around in our hands today? What made the leap from the military into the private sphere?
One interesting thing about GPS is that although it was a military project, from the beginning there was supposed to be some civilian component. It was a condition of its funding, I believe. So there was always going to be some civilian angle to it. Just none of the planners really had it. I mean, Brad, I think, had an idea that it might be used for civil aviation someday, but they never really could. I mean, they couldn't predict, partly because a GPS receiver back then was like the size of a desk. You know, I mean, it was this gigantic, bulky computer. So the idea that it could all be put on a chip that we carry around on our phones would have, you know, even someone as visionary as Parkinson couldn't have seen. But throughout the 70s and 80s, there were a few people who were experimenting with it on the civilian side. Surveyors liked it, and the military tried to wall off. The military, even to this day, has its own GPS signal that only it uses. It's the same concept, same satellites and everything, but the entire rest of the world, you know, uses another signal. And so that was important to the military to keep it separate. What they found was that their signal was maybe more secure than the civilian signal, but it wasn't really that more accurate. You could make the civilian signal more accurate. So what happened really, what burst the whole industry wide open was Operation Desert Storm. I mean, partly because the military, that was when the technology really came of age, when it was pretty clear that this could change warfare. And after that, you know, it was kind of when GPS came on the world stage in a way, that the GPS industry itself started to get underway. Until the year 2000, the military would purposely corrupt the civilian signal a little bit so that it wasn't as accurate as the military signal, because they were, you know, afraid that the story they always tell is, like, you know, what if someone could bomb the White House or bomb the Capitol by these things? But it became clear that there were workarounds around that anyway. In 2000, President Clinton, you know, after consulting with the military, discontinued that system, which was called selective availability. And once that was gone, you know, when it was easy to get really good accuracy with GPS, then the industry really started to grow.
And now we have that ubiquitous little pinpoint that drops wherever you want, depending upon what address you put into your smartphone. Most people, though, don't really understand how GPS works.
Yeah.
They're just glad in some ways that it does, or maybe for reasons we'll talk about later, they're not too happy that it works as well as it does. But to give everybody a quick primer about how satellites actually can pinpoint where you are?
Well, the first thing to realize about GPS is that you're carrying around a GPS receiver with you, but it's a receiver, not a transmitter. GPS is what's called a passive navigation system, which means that you, the user, don't have to transmit anything in order to figure out your location, which was one of the big attractive things about it for the military, because it meant that it was good, you know, for things like, you know, if you wanted to be surreptitious, you couldn't trace the source of the signal, and if you were using it in warfare. So essentially what happens is there's a constellation of 24 active satellites, global positioning satellites. They orbit at 20,000 kilometers above the Earth. And there's a few spares, but there's always 24 that are active. They're arrayed so that pretty much from just about every spot in the world, there's a line of sight to at least four of them. And what happens is when you get a GPS reading is your GPS receiver picks up the signal from at least four of these satellites. And what the signal is telling the receiver is where the satellite was when the signal was released, and also exactly what time it was released. So what your GPS receiver does is it notes that transmission time. And by figuring out the transmission time, it can tell how far it is from the satellite by how far, you know, by how long it took the signal to reach it. And, you know, we're talking, it's 67 milliseconds. So it has to really, really, really be precise, because if the timing is off by even, you know, a millionth of a second, it'll throw you off by sometimes hundreds of miles. But by getting that, by making those calculations simultaneously from at least four satellites, it can turn that information of, you know, how far away it is from the various satellites. It can extrapolate that into actual geographic information, latitude, longitude, and altitude. And also, by the way, provide perfect time. But that's the gist of it, is that it's timing the transmission. It's noting the transmission time of satellite signals to find out how far it is away from the satellites.
So when you, for example, open Google Maps or anything else that you might be using, and you pop in an address that you want to go to, and then you see the map change in front and then the pin drop, what's exactly happening so that it knows where you are? I mean, you've explained sort of the rudimentary part of it, but to someone looking at it saying, how does it know to take me from point A to point B?
Well, part of that is, first of all, it's, you know, Google Maps is something we call a geographic information system, or GIS. And that's important, because when we say that we use GPS, most of us, what we're using is GIS. I mean, GPS by itself is going to provide you the geographic coordinates, just the latitude, longitude, altitude, which was, you know, it's funny to think not too long ago that's what a GPS receiver meant. So if you were using it in the field, it meant just trying to kind of figure out where you were based on those coordinates. A program like Google Maps has data that then can take that information and place it onto a map. But, you know, one interesting thing about programs like Google Maps, it's not so much the Google Maps, but what's happening in your phone, is that GPS is sort of the bulwark of the system, but your phone is also kind of refining that information from Wi-Fi hotspots, Bluetooth, cell phone towers, all this information. It's taking the GPS information and then refining it. And another interesting thing, by the way, is, you know, your phone, at least the iPhones, also have the capability to get the signal from GLONASS satellites, which is Russia's version of GPS. It's the only other system in the world that even approaches GPS in terms of global coverage and a full satellite constellation. So, you know, your iPhone, your iPad is really powerful in that it can take all these signals, and the more signals it can get, the more it can refine them. But so basically it's taking these GPS signals, calculating what the latitude, longitude, and altitude is, and then a program like Google Maps translates that into visual information and drops the pin.
So the next time someone goes out to get a car and they ask you when you're renting it, do you want to have GPS? You say, don't you mean GIS?
Yeah, right. Exactly. If you want to impress them or not impress them, as the case may be, but yeah.
But for anyone who has used that, there are stories that are now sort of, you know, legendary about people going to the very wrong places,
yeah,
and or being, you know, shown very clearly that they truly can't get there from here because where Google Maps has taken them or where any other informational,
yeah,
system has taken them is clearly not what is physically there in the real world. I know you talk a lot about, you know, death by GPS,
yeah,
and that has actually occurred where people have gone into very, very wrong places late at night and or just simply blindly trying to follow,
yeah,
their own systems.
Death by GPS was a term coined by the rangers at Death Valley, it's in California. That's how often this was occurring, where people would follow their GPS. You know, they'd set their directions, and instead of following the posted signs on the road, they would obey their GPS when it told them to turn right onto or left onto what were often technically roads. I mean, they were on a map, and they were obviously in the map data that the program had, but they were, you know, things, maybe old mining roads or things where you had to use off-road vehicles. I mean, Death Valley is enormous, and so they would disappear into Death Valley, and they wouldn't all die, but, you know, several have. And death by GPS, I think, is sort of a catch-all term for this idea of getting into trouble by following your GPS blindly. You know, one thing I think it's important to remember about death by GPS is, you know, I visited the GPS master control station at Schriever Air Force Base in Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs. And that's where they control the day-by-day operations of GPS. And one thing they're always very, very careful to tell you is that, you know, we're in charge of the satellites and the signal. Once that signal leaves the satellite, our work is done. And what they mean by that is that it's the receiving, you know, we do with GPS what we want to do with it. And GPS itself is a very, very robust system. It rarely fails. I mean, one thing about death by GPS is it's almost about GPS working too well. It's about GPS being, you know, program having so much data that it can find you these routes that technically exist, but you shouldn't take them. And that's not the fault of GPS. That's either the fault of the map data, or, I mean, if you want to not be so charitable to people, it's the fault of, you know, lack of common sense and sort of a blindly following this technology where it takes you. I mean, you hear some of these stories and of people like driving into an ocean because their GPS told them that they should turn right there, that there was a bridge. And what you hear a lot of these people say is variations when they're asked why. They say, like, GPS told me there was a road. You know, I trusted GPS. And there's something about it. They just blindly put their faith in it. And it's not really the fault of GPS almost all the time. I mean, that signal is almost always correct.
Which is to say that perhaps the faith that we have in that little device in our cars, if it's already pre-installed, or if we're just looking on our smartphones, has to be looked at with a fair measure of wariness.
Yeah.
And also to note that, you know, yes, it can be wrong, but do you really need to rely on it as much? I mean, I see people here in Hawaii all the time looking at their little phones, trying to figure out how to get down the street.
Yeah. It's funny in Hawaii, too, because if you use the turn-by-turn directions, it just totally garbles the street names, which I think is funny. Yeah, I mean, and I should say I'm not exempting myself. I mean, there's just something, I guess it's sort of analogous to when, you know basic math, but you take out the calculator in a restaurant to calculate the tip, even though you really know what 15 or 20% is. Somehow you want reassurance, or it's just easier. People will say, and I don't think this is that uncommon, that routes they've taken many, many times, once they get GPS, they'll plug it in because it's really the mystery, right? I mean, partly it's because, well, why not? There's something about turning off that part of your brain and letting the GPS unit do the navigating for you. And it's just a really alluring thing.
You tell the story of GPS through many different stories, and you've just alluded to a couple of them. You're also starting from a very specific location and point in time to be able to tell that story. Why did you choose that? Is it because of the fact that you're from here?
Well, that didn't hurt. I mean, I'd always been interested. You know, I grew up here, so I knew the rudiments of Polynesian navigation. But I should say, really, the rudiments. I mean, I learned a lot by doing this, and I was just curious how, before there was something, you know, hundreds of years before there was something like this, how people could find these specks in the ocean, and not just find them, but go between them. And so, I was curious what, you know, how they did that. And obviously what they did could fill a book, how they did it could fill a book and could fill several books. But one thing that I discovered is that for them, the issue of time wasn't as important as it was for Europeans and for us. And what I mean by that is, you know, European sailors, they need, in order to figure out where exactly they were, latitude was pretty easy to calculate, but longitude was very difficult to calculate. And so what you really need is on the ocean is you need a dependable way to tell time. That's the best way to calculate longitude. And it was very difficult to build clocks that were seaworthy. And finally, they built one called a chronometer. Polynesian navigation didn't need any of that. And partly, without going into too many details, is that location was contingent. I mean, when we look at a map and we say we're here, we're saying that in a language that should be, you know, translatable to anyone, because latitude and longitude are latitude and longitude. For Polynesian navigators, where you were depended on where you were in relation to various islands. If you want to go from one island to another island, to kind of get a gauge in your head where you were, you chose a reference island that was out there. You couldn't see it, but it was how you knew what to navigate by. And that's a really difficult concept to figure out. But the point is that they didn't have to know exactly the time right at any given moment in order to find where they were. European ship captains did. Before the chronometer, there were, you know, it's really horrible, horrible shipwrecks caused by the fact that they never really knew where they were, or else they would just hug the latitude lines. So the chronometer, which was essentially just a way to a very, very, very accurate clock that would stay accurate on the ocean, is the precursor to GPS, which again is, you know, essentially just a clock. I mean, when you get right down to it, it's a satellite signal with time on it. And that's why I decided to start with Polynesian navigation, because it was a way to show that what we sort of accept as the only way to gauge where we are, not so much navigating, but positioning, just to define where we are in the world, is not the only way to do it. It's just the way that we've been brought up to think about it.
That's Greg Milner, author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. This afternoon we're recorded, so just a reminder, the phone lines aren't available. In this next segment, I asked him about what some scientists are suggesting may be happening to our brains as we adapt to how GPS works, and if that's making us less smart.
That's what they're wondering about. There have been studies of taxi drivers in London who have to memorize enormous amounts of geographic information and streets and famous landmarks in a very confusing city. And what they've found is that the gray matter volume is greater in the part of the brain that's, for them, that's responsible for complex spatial relations. And one interesting corollary of that, and this is a little bit more, they're not so completely sure of this, but it looks like when they retire, that gray matter shrinks a little. In other words, when they don't need to memorize that anymore. So there's some speculation that if we're using GPS all the time, that something similar could be happening to us, because we no longer need to know, use that part of our brain that's responsible for complex spatial relations. A lot of cognitive scientists talk about something called the cognitive map. And it's usually more a construct, not like a part of the brain, but it's what we use to figure out where we are in relation to everything else. It's our cognitive map is how we navigate the world, essentially. And so a lot of cognitive scientists are saying that what GPS use really does is it shrinks our cognitive map. It makes it narrower, essentially. We no longer have to figure out where anything is in relation to anything else. And, you know, everybody knows who's used GPS to drive through a strange city how great that is, because you don't have to know where you are in relation to anything. You're just kind of zipping through the environment. And among other things, they've shown that that's, I mean, we all know this in our hearts, that it makes drivers more disengaged from their environment. But the larger connotation could be that it's shrinking our cognitive map. It's just making us less able to use that part of our mind.
And less aware of some of the beauty that might be around us, too, when you're simply just looking at the map in a strange city.
Yeah.
And obviously, there's a nice, confident feeling when you think, I can get there. I've got this thing. except for the fact that there are people that you could be asking or directions you could have gotten beforehand and something that would have been old school that might make you able to engage in a very different way, which is to say, how much reliance on GPS is really healthy?
Well, that's an open question. I can tell you that, well, let me put it this way, there's sometimes sort of unintended consequences that can work out well. I mean, there was a man in the paper recently, an American tourist in Iceland, who became sort of famous in Iceland and then somewhat famous internationally because he programmed his GPS to get him from the airport to Reykjavik, where his hotel was. And actually, he didn't do anything wrong, which is interesting to point out to show how many ways there are for GPS to fail you, even when you're doing everything right. He put in the name of the street sign right, copied from his booking confirmation, but it turned out that that was misspelled and that it actually was a spelling of a street in a fishing village, you know, 250 miles away up near the Arctic Circle. And for those usual mysterious reasons, he followed that all the way there. He said that, "I was tired. I trusted GPS to get me there." Even as he was passing signs, it showed him Reykjavik's back that way. But what I found most interesting about that story is that he got to this fishing village and then decided to stick around because it was, you know, he would never have gone there. And it was beautiful and this interesting place. Although I imagine someone there must have narked him out because I don't know how the Icelandic media found out about this. But he stayed there. You know, it was beautiful. And it's so there can be sometimes nice unintended consequences of this. So, you know, was it healthy that he used GPS when he really probably didn't have to? But, you know, maybe not. But it sometimes it ends up being kind of having a nice unintended result.
So he really was the accidental GPS tourist.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the stories, though, do not turn out that well. You talk about one concerning a couple who were just trying to get to Las Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, and this is a perfect example of how, you know, it's hard to figure out who to blame in situations like this. This couple, it was a husband and wife, Rita and Albert Chrétien. They were going to drive from a small town in British Columbia to Las Vegas for a trade show. And they weren't in any hurry, so they, you know, along the way there, they decided to take a different route that they thought would get them to this main highway. When they realized it didn't, then they, which I think is important to point out because they didn't rely on GPS at first. I think they were looking at maps, but it looked to them like there had to be a way back to this highway, and they realized it wasn't. Then they used GPS to get them to find them a better way.
And we should say that they couldn't turn around at some point.
Right. Well, that's what happened was, also an important thing to realize is they didn't tell anyone they were doing this. So no one knew where they were. GPS guided them onto a road to get them back to the main highway that took them deep into this really, probably some of the most remote areas in the country, these mountainous areas in Nevada. I think they had a minivan that should never have gone on these roads. I mean, it was an especially bad situation because, as the sheriff would later point out, the road starts out good and just slowly gets worse, and they were doing it at night. So it almost like it crept up on them, and at some point they were, you know, driving this place where they should have had an off-road vehicle, and eventually they just fell off a road, I think, into a ditch and were stuck. And nobody knew where they were, and they tried to find help and couldn't. And, you know, I think it was 50-some days later, Rita was – well, you know what? I actually don't want to necessarily give away what happens in the story, but it's a really – it's somewhat of a – it's a tragic story with a sort of silver lining. But the point being that there was a sort of tale of survival in this. It doesn't work out really well, but it shows how much trouble GPS can get you into because – I can't really fault the Chrétiens for doing anything wrong, really. I mean, it's maybe they should have paid more attention to the paper map. Maybe they should have asked for directions. But it turns out the signage that they encountered was also misleading. That's not the fault of GPS. That's the fault of whatever, you know, the county that was that put up those signs. It made it seem like they were coming to a town when they were really just coming to a creek. I think this story resonates with people, too, because honestly, I think if we're all being honest with ourselves, we can imagine doing something similar. I mean, it just shows how even in a country as populous as this, it's not that hard to get really lost. And using a technology whose promise is, ironically, that you'll never get lost again. Right. That's the, I mean, that really, that's the implicit promise of GPS as it's used by most people. Like, you'll never get lost. How can you get lost if GPS always tells you where you are? And yet it made these people get more lost than they normally would.
Especially when you have a unit that's only supposed to be inside a vehicle.
Yeah.
And if you try to remove it or use it some other place, I've seen people take them out and they realize this is not working. And even if they don't have their smartphones with them, but some of the other instructional things in there that are just commonsensical that we seem to be leaving behind, like telling people that we're going to go off and do that.
Yeah.
And when you start to get that niggling feeling in the pit of your stomach to say, maybe there's a reason we should just stop here and wait it out, not being places late at night where you're out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, real common sense stuff that seems to be going by the wayside because of this great reliance on this neat thing that we all use.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Ed Tuck, who's founded the company Magellan, probably a lot of people who have GPS units in their cars have Magellans. He said one of his sort of brainstorms was that he had grown up, I think, in Missouri, and he'd said, like, he had in his mind this ideal customer named Bubba, and Bubba doesn't like to ask for directions. And that's sort of, and it's kind of brilliant in a way because, that's
like most men we know.
Yeah, probably. I guess I can't really exempt myself from that. But, I mean, that's the thing. I can see myself getting into the situation that the Chrétiens did. I can't, again, without giving too many details, I can't see having the incredible survival skills that Rita Chrétien had. But I can see myself getting into these situations. I don't like to ask for directions. I think that stereotype is probably somewhat true. And so Bubba doesn't like to ask for directions. And it was a really, I think, a kind of a stroke of genius in a way. Didn't help him get, he still had to talk to, I think, like 85 different people before he got any venture capital because, again, it seemed so weird. Why would anyone want this? Even then, it seemed there were a lot of people who felt that.
And a lot of people think that about many things that come out that are wildly successful until you realize that somebody really saw a need that we didn't realize ourselves until suddenly we were presented with a way of meeting it.
Well, that's what's fascinating to me about GPS is that it's really a blank slate. I mean, there's nothing about the technology that said this should be used to drop 5 bombs in one hole. It was just what one visionary saw as it. I mean, really, GPS is just... When you get right down to it, it's just a signal. It's just a satellite signal, a radio beacon, really, that has information in it. But we come up with all these different ways to use it. I mean, who would have thought? I can't imagine. Well, there's no way they could foresee all the different ways it was going to be used for tracking, for example. I mean, that we track everything with GPS, people, animals, dementia patients, convicts, suspected felons. And there's nothing inherent about GPS that makes that easy to do that. It's something we thought to do. And a GPS tracker is basically a GPS receiver with a cell phone attached to it. So it's really that added-on technology that makes it. So, I mean, that was one of the most fascinating things for me about doing this was just to come up with – was just find all these ways that people thought to use GPS that nobody ever would have. I mean, GPS can track the movement of tectonic plates – by like the millimeter. And that's, I think it's important for people to realize when I say GPS does that, that's the same GPS that's guiding us in our cars. I mean, but we've been able to adapt it. Geophysicists figured out this way to adapt it in this way that lets them, take the measure of the Earth in a way that they could do it before, but not as easily as they can do now. And it's being used to monitor earthquakes.
And I want to ask you about that because for most of us, the idea of earthquakes is synonymous with seismic activity.
Yeah.
But the way in which that's measured isn't necessarily the way that we have had it measured in past. In fact, you tell a story in the book about a young scientist who said, no, look, it can do this.
Yeah.
And instead was told by her professor that, no.
Yeah, she's a geophysicist, Christine Larson at the University of Colorado, who's done some of the real groundbreaking adaptations of GPS. And she was studying earthquakes with GPS, and she showed her, a former professor, a sort of a printout of what the earthquake looked like. And he said, no, earthquakes don't look like this. And that was because she had, before then, earthquakes were just measured with seismic instruments. And for one thing, the problem with traditional seismic instruments is that they clip, by which I mean that if the seismic activity is really high, they overload. They can't measure it. They just basically like shut themselves off.
And aren't they also very remote from the place they're usually measuring?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. They're remote. The place they're usually measuring is remote, and they're just not. That's the best that we've had. They're not that they can't really measure everything about an earthquake. Plus, they can measure like the shaking really well, and that's why you know that's a very noisy looking image. It's you know it's the earth moving. What they can't show, and what I think she and others have showed that GPS can show, is where the earth ends up after an earthquake. You know, the earth starts one way in one place. At the end of the earthquake, it's moved, you know, that spot, whatever spot has moved a few feet.
So it can measure change.
Right. It can measure change. And then not only that, but it can measure the initial displacement, but then over time how the earth then maybe, you know, moves back a little bit. Seismic instruments can't do any of that. And partly why I think her colleague said that, she explained, is that you know, when you look at the visual data for that, it's not noisy at all. It's just the earth kind of moving one place. You know, it starts at the you know, before the earthquake, it's here, and at the end, it's moved to somewhere else. And then over the next several months or years, it moves back. You know, it even more. But yeah, you can't do that with seismic instruments. And so what a lot of earthquake experts are trying to do now is do something called seismogeodesy, and that's it's what it means essentially is combining GPS receivers with traditional seismic instruments. And what's fascinating about this to me is that there are already hundreds, well, probably thousands of very scientific level GPS receivers scattered around the world that were installed to measure tectonic plates. And what they've realized is that they can use they can adapt them by putting little seismographs with them. Co-located, and so they can also look at earthquake activity. They can't predict earthquakes. I mean, you talk to geophysicists, and they say no one who says they can predict an earthquake is telling the truth. But what they can do, with combining these two technologies, is give a little bit of a heads up of that an earthquake is that a large earthquake is coming, because for example, like in Japan, the 2011 quake in Japan. The 2011 quake in Japan, they took them something like, I think, 45 minutes or so to figure out exactly how big the earthquake was, and so by extension, how big the tsunami was going to be. And what's interesting about that is that they have one of the most advanced seismic networks in the world, and it performed as well as it could, but the earthquake was so big that, it sort of clipped. And what they have to do in those cases is quickly use different data to try to figure out themselves based on various things how big the earthquake is. So because they didn't know how big the earthquake is, they didn't know how big the tsunami is. And if they had integrated GPS into that, and by the way, they also had probably the world's most advanced network of GPS receivers scattered around the area to measure tectonic plates, if those had somehow been combined, they would have been able to figure out much quicker how big the earthquake was. I think the final estimate of the size of the power of the earthquake was something like 900 times more powerful than they originally thought. And they would have very probably been able to get a sense of how big the tsunami was going to be and been able to evacuate, or get people would have had a head start, really is what they're saying, is that they would have had more of a sense of what was coming. We'll never know how many lives that could have saved, but it's became clear, and I think since then, that this is something that we really need, to integrate GPS and seismic technologies together.
So how well integrated do you think that they're becoming, as obviously we have this incredible example of what could have happened and the irony of having had all of those GPS receivers around, that we might have known so much better what might have been coming.
Yeah.
And now, for us, particularly as we're floating around the Pacific here, trying to understand what may happen if there's a tsunami, and the jokes that we make, oh, yeah, there'll be a little blip, or you'll just sort of watch this tiny bit of water just pull back and a little bit of rise. We really haven't had many, many examples, obviously some very horrendous ones that people can point to historically. Yeah. But most of the time, people don't necessarily take, tsunami warnings seriously. I mean, we have people who go out swimming in them, for heaven's sake.
I can remember as a kid being evacuated for a tsunami warning, and it ended up when it hit us being like a 8-foot wave or something. And yeah, I think people think that's what all tsunamis are. Yeah, I mean, I know they're taking this very seriously in Southern California and the Pacific Northwest. I mean, both places are way overdue from what they call mega quakes. And in fact, what happened in Japan, something very, very similar could and eventually probably will happen in the Pacific Northwest. And down in Southern California, the San Andreas down in Chile is way overdue for that. So there, it's a slow and steady process. Essentially, it means these geophysicists and their teams going out to these areas, often remote, where there've already been GPS receivers set up to measure plate tectonics, and putting this new technology into them. Eventually it'll be really advanced. I mean, eventually will happen is those networks will be combined and integrated, and when that kind of activity happens, if the system detects that it's a huge quake, certain things will happen, like gas mains will probably automatically be shut off. Like hospitals would get like a really quick warning that this was coming, because, you know, when those big quakes hit, it's the damage is going to not so much necessarily be from the quakes, but from the aftermath, things like the fires and, you know, firefighters unable to get through because roads are damaged and the gas fires is going out of control. So,
you know, most people who have a memory long enough to remember the Northridge earthquake,
right,
and the damage that was done there.
Yeah.
And most of it that happened as a result of the earthquake, not the earthquake itself.
Yeah, the Northridge quake, I think, was in fact a big... it was what got a lot of people in the U.S. sort of looking at these alternate technologies because that was kind of a wake-up call, as I understand it.
Do you see any timeline in having that technology be that well integrated?
The person who spearheaded that the most is this is at UC San Diego, named Yehuda Bach. And I have asked him about a timeline, actually, and he's hesitant to give one. He says it's just a very slow step. I mean, they've already got several. I mean, they're adding more every day. But when everything is all hooked up, the entire, you know, West Coast essentially is all, you know, on this one network, I don't know. It'll be a while, but it's a slow and steady. It's happening.
What's also happening as we look at GPS is that, as you mentioned earlier, with our movements able to be tracked, with our ability to track other people for good reasons or maybe not so good reasons, that's also a lot of data that is being collected. And that brings up the whole issue of privacy and also how other things are being marketed to us. With our great concerns over privacy and whether that is now an obsolete term, how do you see privacy in the developing GPS network?
Well, I think for one thing, there has to be, and legal systems are struggling with this, I think there has to be a sort of revised idea of what privacy is, because, you know, if someone is tracked surreptitiously by a GPS receiver, which police sometimes do, if they're just tracking their location on public roads, then you could make the argument like, well, that's no different than if the police were following them in their car, which they're allowed to do. The difference is that the amount of data they can collect is enormous, and they can do it so easily. I mean, it doesn't take any work at all. They attach something to someone's car, and they sit back and let their software, the special software for the strangers, gather reams and reams and reams of data 24 hours. And so, I mean, European countries, I think, are a little bit further ahead of us on this, some of them, and the idea that, like, well, that can be a privacy violation. Even if you're just tracking them on private roads, the fact that you're essentially watching them 24 hours a day, I mean, you can find out a lot about people by just seeing where they go. You can find out a lot about, you know, their sexual habits, their religious habits, you know, who they associate with. I mean, what some of the software does that tracks people is it can even sort of cross-reference if they're meeting with other people who are tracking. You can just find out. You can find out if they've gone to their 12-step meeting. You can find out if they're 5 minutes late for work. I mean, you can really, really keep tabs on people, and it's so easy to do. I mean, one of the things that I learned in this book is that one of the fastest-growing segments of the GPS industry is what's called fleet management. It's, you know, bosses essentially attaching GPS receivers to their employees' cars who drive, you know, it's company cars or government cars, which you wouldn't think it's as big as, but there's lots and lots of people driving, you know, cars that are government agencies. And
it says something about us, too.
Well, it says something about us in that, like, overwhelmingly, when they've taken surveys, what the employers say is the best thing about this is just knowing where their employees are. And the reason I find that interesting is because the savings is also enormous. I mean, they've proven when employees know they're being watched, they're driving, like, they don't stop as long, they don't take detours. The time and money and gas savings really add up. And you would think that would be the best thing about it, but that's not what, you know, that's number two. What employers tend to say is the best thing about it is knowing where my employees are. And the unintended consequences of that, of course, is that it's very easy to get GPS jammers. They're very cheap. You can get them on the internet. And so what a lot of people are doing now who are in driving, being under surveillance with these fleet management systems, is they carry a GPS jammer with them that if they don't want the system to know where they are, they turn on the jammer. It creates a little bubble of interference around them. It disrupts the GPS signal, so the system can't record it.
It was a nice bit of business for someone who saw that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're illegal, but it's one of those things. It's probably, I guess, like drug paraphernalia. It's easy to obtain if you really want it. And, you know, it's at this point, the Department of Homeland Security recently did a study that found that a lot of small plane pilots who rely on GPS, actually even more than large commercial jets do, they don't like to fly too low over major freeways, especially near rest stops, because there's so many GPS jammers being used by truckers or whatever that it's messing with their navigation system.
So they're becoming a safety hazard.
Yeah, become a safety hazard, and all just a general all around nuisance. You know, it's the last thing you want when you're in the air is to try to like mess around with this system that's telling you where you are and where you're going. So they'll just avoid it. In Newark Airport in New Jersey, is the runways go right near the New Jersey Turnpike. And Newark was chosen as the first airport, I think, to have a functioning, this very cutting-edge system that could land planes, a GPS-based system. It was powerful enough to land, you know, a 747 in zero-degree visibility weather. I mean, that's how advanced this system is. It could guide them in. And during testing, it kept shorting out. It kept shutting itself down because there were so many jammers on the turnpike, which was really only, you know, a few yards away. And they found a workaround on it, but it was something that they never expected. And these are really smart engineers who put this in, but who knew obviously the dangers of jamming, the possibilities of it, but it never occurred to them that all these small little jammers, which they're called personal privacy devices, which I think is a great euphemism, although fleet management is also a great euphemism, and that's how popular these things become. Like several times a day, the system would just take itself offline.
Greg, what about perfectly intended consequences to bring down a grid?
You mean what people worry about more who think about this is not so much jamming as something called spoofing. Jamming is obviously a serious problem, but it's also something that you can notice immediately. I mean, if someone jams a GPS signal, the GPS signal just isn't there. What spoofing is, and it's much more potentially dangerous, is somebody introducing a phantom GPS signal, a bogus GPS signal that overwhelms the real one for GPS receivers in that general area. Those receivers then think that's a GPS signal, and then they use that data. And because it looks like the GPS signal, it can take a long time to figure out even something's wrong, and damage can be done really quickly. And that's going to become a serious problem if it's not already, because it's easy to spoof, relatively easy to spoof that they've shown. It's difficult to spoof in a way that's really, really effective, but that stuff is now becoming more. I mean, just last summer, people were uploading software-based GPS spoofers, essentially lines of code that if you know what you're doing, you could download and integrate into a piece of hardware. And the main reason why spoofing is bad is not so much for messing up GPS's location abilities, but for messing up GPS as a timepiece. One of the kind of big secrets of GPS that I think a lot of people don't realize is that in terms of pure usage, it's more important as a regulator of time than it is as a position or navigation device. That signal is really, really, you know, the timing is, it has to be really, really, really synchronized. So it's a great way for systems around the world to integrate grids that over large geographic areas that need timing regulations. the electrical grid, for example, is measured by taking snapshots at various precise intervals of the state of the grid, how the power is moving. Those systems are regulated by GPS time, because if they don't all take that snapshot at the same millisecond, it's worthless. It's cell towers use GPS time to hand off calls. Landline phone systems all use GPS for the timing of different networks. Timing really runs the world, and a lot of that timing is provided by GPS, because it's free, it's very dependable, and it's available worldwide. Every financial transaction pretty much has got a GPS-based timestamp on it. So the fear among people is that if someone were to deploy a spoofer, let's say over a small area even, and they messed up the timing of, let's say an electrical substation or cell towers, it only takes, tiny fractions of a second. So if the spoofed GPS signal had a time signal that was a little bit off, it could throw everything off and cause a sort of chain reaction of things shutting down. There's an engineer professor at the University of Texas who's been studying this a lot and basically spent the last 4 years showing the government that the spoofer he built could take out all these different systems. And Homeland Security is very concerned. I know they're concerned because they wouldn't talk to me about it, but it's something that they're now very, very aware of GPS's vulnerabilities and how porous the system is. I mean, I don't think there's been a utility maybe in the history of the world that's taken over so quickly as GPS. It's sort of blanketed and saturated the earth before people could really get a handle on the security ramifications of it. And so they're sort of scrambling now to kind of backtrack.
Greg Milner is the author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. He was recently in Honolulu, and we recorded our conversation, so the phone lines aren't available. In this next segment, we looked at the nexus of GPS and time.
GPS is a very accurate clock, but a better way to look at it is an incredibly accurate stopwatch. I mean, it's used as a way, like even timing itself. I mean, the universal coordinated time, and it's which is sort of the closest the world has to a standard, is done in France by taking, I think it's about 200 of the most powerful clocks around the world and comparing their time signal and constantly tweaking it a little. And those clocks compare themselves with each other all the time, and they use GPS time. It used to be that the head of the timing division at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Colorado, which is kind of keeps the official American civilian time, he told me that before GPS, if they wanted to kind of regulate their clock, they would have to take a portable version of it on the plane to D.C., pick up the portable version of the military clock that was at the Naval Observatory there, fly them to France, where they would hook them up to the main one there and compare them, and then fly them all the way back. So once GPS came along, I mean, it still was a lot of post-processing work and complicated software, but now they could just do it from their office. And yeah, so if you spoof GPS, I like the way you say it, you're warping time. I mean, you're basically introducing a completely different sense of time into the world, and that can have really, really bad consequences.
I mean, this isn't like the stopwatch in Harry Potter that you click right. And all of a sudden you get more time and you can be two places at once.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, it's one of the big fears that this engineer at Texas has is that he's particularly concerned about is financial trading, because, the major stock exchanges use GPS time to regulate the timestamp, and especially in an age of high frequency trading, the milliseconds equal differences of millions of dollars. He told me that he's satisfied that the exchanges themselves have taken anti-spoofing measures that make it difficult to spoof. What he's concerned about are the high frequency traders, the people who basically make their living getting in and out of the market in nanoseconds. They, in order to get that little that extra geographic advantage, co-locate their computers at the same locations where the exchanges have their own computers, so that there's that minimal distance between them and the computers.
They're pretty much in sync.
They're pretty much in sync, yeah. And a lot of those traders prefer to get their own time signal. In other words, to not take it like something from directly on the roofs, let's say, of the stock exchange, not going through any of these anti-spoofing measures. So he's afraid that if someone were to it would be easy to spoof those guys if it threw off those automatic trading programs by even a little bit. It's all automated, so they would possibly take themselves off, just offline, take themselves out of the market, which would then create a chain reaction. So all it would take is a few of these trading computers getting a phantom GPS signal that confuses them because the time signal makes no sense to them. And they take themselves out, others take themselves out. And he compares it to, there was something in 2010 called the flash crash, where the market basically just dropped precipitously in a scary way for, you know, and then just rebounded a couple minutes later. And that's, he thinks that something like that could easily happen, but, you know, on a worse level if people were to spoof it. I mean, one thing that I think it's important for people to realize is when I say GPS is vulnerable, GPS itself, the system, is very secure. I mean, you'd either have to, in order to take out the whole system, you'd either need a weapon that could destroy the satellites, which that's unlikely, or you'd have to infiltrate the GPS master control station in Colorado. And I've been there, and there's no way you're going to do that. I mean, there's posters authorizing deadly force. You go through doors that if you don't go through them in a few seconds, the alarms will go off. When I was there, my name was on a big monitor to remind everyone that I was in the room, along with a big flashing red light. So that, the point is, it's not, people are not going to take out GPS by itself. But the fear with spoofing is that even by doing these little localized interruptions, you could have a very bad effect. And by the way, I should say it isn't just timing. This professor at Texas, one of the first public demonstrations he did that really, really alarmed the government and the military, is that he showed that from about a mile away, he could spoof a commercial drone aircraft. He took control of it by aiming his spoofing signal at it and made it think that it was 200 feet higher than it was. So it dove towards the earth, and he managed to get it back up just in time. But it was a very dramatic image that I think really alarmed them, because, I mean, as we all know, drones are just multiplying in the sky right now. And it's another perfect example of, there's no way that those GPS architects could have ever foreseen this. Brad Parkinson thought that aviation would be the main thing the main area that would embrace GPS, and even he could not have imagined this time. I mean, when there's going to be thousands of drones in the sky, so you know, you can think about that. There's a lot of things that can go wrong if people can take control of drones and do with them what they want. So.
You're also talking about changes externally and changes internally. As we use this, as we are concerned about spoofing, as all, obviously, when new ideas come along and we have to assimilate them and be able to respond to them, particularly as you're talking about a lot of issues of safety and well-being.
Yeah.
But some very basic changes to how we may be mapping our own map internally, how our brains may be changing, and not just the fact that, you know, in not doing some of these things manually, as you were talking a little earlier in the hour about taxi cab drivers in London.
Yeah.
And the gray matter and how that simply was shrinking when they didn't have to do that anymore, but how we are learning how to use all this and the changes that are happening with our own brains seems to be suggesting that, you know, sort of as it arranges us, or we're arranging it, it's arranging us.
Yeah, I mean, it's changing us in fundamental ways that we're only beginning to understand. I mean, one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of GPS is the Air Force calls it the world's only global utility. And the first time I heard that, I thought, oh, that's hyperbole. But, you know, it is. It's become worldwide, and I think because it's worldwide, it's changing. I don't want to be too dramatic, but I feel like it's changing us as a species. It's changing the way that we think about space and how much we rely on time. Even if it's not literally having a physiological effect on our brains, and like I said, the research is very preliminary, so I don't want to make too much of it. This is just a theory that I talked to some neuroscientists who were involved in the taxicab study, and you know, at least one of them told me that it would be hard to prove, but he can see it would be very possible that GPS use would have a similar effect as what they observed in the retired taxi cab drivers when the gray matter shrank. But even if nothing is happening with our brains physiologically, the cognitive map as a sort of construct is, I think, definitely changing. I mean, when we no longer need to know where everything is in relation to everything else, it just changes how engaged we are in the world. The person who coined the term cognitive map as a psychologist at UC Berkeley in the 40s, And he used it because he wanted to argue that rats in a maze had a very could actually form mental images of the way the entire maze was laid out, where if one thing, not just how to get from where they were to the reward, but how they, where that was in relation to other parts of the maze. And he talked about comprehensive maps versus strip maps. And a strip map would be, you know, just knowing where A, how to get from A to B and knowing what was there, but not really knowing what was around it, the larger context. He argued that rats could have not just strip maps, but comprehensive cognitive maps, that the more they ran the map, the more they ran the maze, the more these maps grew in complexity. I think when you look at a lot of the death by GPS people, I mean, it's hard not to think that what's happening to them, and they might be canaries in the coal mine, is that their cognitive maps are shrinking. They're becoming strip maps, really, because really with GPS, you can have a strip map location with the world. You don't really have to have any sort of like comprehensive cognitive map. You just don't.
But that sort of brings us to the end of this hour and also the end of the book, where you come right back to the world of Hawaii and the Hokulea.
Yeah. I mean, it's I wanted to show that, you know, that they had figured out, you know, how the Polynesians navigated. They pretty much knew it before there was, you know, a lot of scientists that, you know, had basically said for sure. But yeah, I wanted to. It came back to Hokulea to show that there is still another way to think. I'm not saying that any of us should learn how to navigate by the stars or should learn what a reference island is. I think that Noah Thompson, he realized that it would have taken him a lifetime to learn that, because that's navigators started as children. So he, as I understand it, he took a little bit of that and integrated it with his own kind of a system of his own invention. But I wanted to show that not just that stuff survives, but that there are other ways that we should at the very least think about that. What GPS can do for us is make us realize that stuff we take for granted about how we see ourselves, our position in the world, it doesn't have to necessarily be that way. I mean, you know, they use GPS for Mars probes, for the Mars spaceship. They use it for spacecraft because GPS can help the gigantic antennas of the deep space network that are on Earth deal with the little fluctuations of the Earth. I mean, the Earth is always moving in different ways. And it's almost as though we're still using the Earth as a reference island. You know, what we look back on. And I think GPS is, at the very least, we can realize that GPS is one way of thinking about the world or the universe or space and how spatial relations, but it's not the only way.
And you've given us a lot to think about the next time we see that little red pin drop.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Greg Milner. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Milner is a senior contributing writer and columnist for Spin Magazine. His work also appears in Slate, Salon, The Village Voice, and Wired, and other publications. He's the author of Perfecting Sound Forever, and his latest book is Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds. We spoke during his recent visit to Honolulu. Thanks for joining us tonight for Town Square. We'll be back live in the studio next week. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Aloha.